Join the Betamax Video Club. We're winding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson. Tonight I've rented Night Shift. Watching with me is Simon Smith. Hi, Simon. How are you?
Good evening, Rich. I'm very well.
Thank you for coming back. And I will change this slightly. I normally thank people for bringing their Betamax copy of the movie. Thank you for sending me an iTunes copy of this film to watch. I'd never seen it before. I'd seen posters and bits and bobs. What is so special about Night Shift for you?
This is one of my favourite ever films. This is in my top 10. It's probably in my top three comedies that I've ever seen. I first saw it when I was sort of 13 years old. And I shouldn't have seen it at 13 because of the subject matter. But I loved it straight away and I loved Keaton immediately. It's a really funny film and I always end up having to make people go and see it. It kind of slips through the net. And when you think it's a Ron Howard film and you look at the sort of lexicon filmography that he's done, it's never talked about. It's like, you know, there's big reasons this should be talked about. It's Ron Howard's first cinematic release as a director. They did it between shooting seasons, the final seasons of Happy Days. So Henry Winkler and Ron Howard were still on Happy Days when they filmed this. It's got Shelley Lowell, an 80s Betamax Video Club stalwart, and it's Michael Keaton's breakout role. And what a breakout role. It is an amazing performance by Keaton.
He was amazing. And I think having seen, obviously, a lot of his later work, I mean, you know, we talked off air about, I mean, he will be, and this will come up throughout, he's my Batman. He's the one that I was, well, 9 or 10 when that came out, and, you know, throughout, and the recent stories that he might come back and do a Batman appearance again. And then you go back to this, where he's younger, he's fresher, he's kind of that, you know, 1982, fairly unknown. You know, he hadn't done an awful lot before this. He went on to do a lot of, you know, really popular comedies throughout the 80s. And seeing him here, he was this kind of wild, you know, off the leash a little bit in the way that you could see going forward. And when I was reading the trivia for this, that one of the other people they considered for it was Belushi.
Yeah, John Belushi was the first choice for this.
Yeah, and you kind of think that that's clearly what they were going for. And I think it would have been strange to see that. I mean, maybe John Belushi might have, I say, stolen the role or anything like that, you know. But I think that the relationship between Michael Keaton and Henry Winkler worked so well, the chemistry between the two, that perhaps these, you know, and it often happens, these kind of accidental, you know, you go for your second or third choice casting, it actually turn out probably for the better.
What's really good about Keaton in this as well, because although he's sort of off the leash and sort of a bit wild, there's some really, really nuanced, sweet little scenes. And we'll come to them as we go through the film. But one in particular that stands out is when they're drunk at Christmas and you get Billy Blazejowski's background about his dad left and said he'd never amount to anything. And you see where all the bravura and the bravado comes from. Because of how he is. And when Keaton does that, there is a moral centre to him. You know, like he's a good guy. And he has terrible ideas, but they're well-intentioned. And I like that.
I mean, the film, and you sort of mentioned about when you first saw it and you were quite young, and I didn't see it because, to be honest, having seen in our mobile video van, I think they were mostly VHS, but he had the flyers for the films, and I think the idea of a prostitution ring, or at least they were being pimps running out of a city morgue, it's a strange premise to kind of sell, especially to younger viewers, that it's amazing. And I wonder if perhaps that's why it hasn't landed as big or something. It didn't have that run up with the youngsters that you could talk about in the playground or something like that.
Yeah, I think the synopsis even today is probably why it doesn't get many ITV4 or late night Channel 4 showings, because it's like, you know, it is about two guys that run a prostitution ring from a city morgue. And that's the joke. But it's so tight and it's done so well. And it's genuinely, it has four or five genuinely laugh out loud funny moments. And Henry Winkler is also brilliant because he plays against type. He's at the height of his fame in 1982. He's like seven seasons into Happy Days, or nine seasons into Happy Days, I think. I think Happy Days started 74. So he's the Fonz, you know. And Ron Howard apparently sort of considered him for the Michael Keaton role. Thought he could have pulled off the Michael Keaton role. But Henry Winkler was really keen to do the Chuck Lumley role, the sort of slightly downtrodden mortuary assistant. And he is wonderful at it. He does so much reacting to Keaton, and he does it beautifully. And it's a really good, I'm surprised you didn't see him in more 80s comedies. It's a pretty good pairing. And of course, we get lots of Bond actors pop up in this as well, in little cameos.
Yeah, it ties in nicely because, I mean, we've had Grandel Bush, wonderfully named Grandel Bush. He was in License to Kill. He was the other special agent Johnson in Die Hard.
That's right.
He was also one of the prisoners in Stir Crazy.
And it's a great opening, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic because, I mean, one of the things I loved as well was when I flicked through the credits before I saw the film. And, I mean, this is one of those things, you see a lot of names in there that you recognise. I mean, we'll go into a couple later. But when you see Richard Belzer,
yeah,
who was Munch in Homicide: Life on the Streets, which is, you know, one of these things that, I mean, it's kind of seen as a prequel to The Wire almost. But it's, I mean, it's a great show in its own way. And he's in here as a, I mean, the kind of relate. I mean, what's a pimp's pimp? I don't know what they call it. Yeah. Pimp management. And they're chasing an actual pimp dressed in cowboy boots and all white for the streets. And I mean, it's almost like I'm Going to Get You, Sucker, the setup where they throw him out, once they finally get him and throw him out the window, while Grandel Bush and his mate are geeing each other up to do a slam dunk.
But that isn't beautiful. It so beautifully shot as the chair exits the window and you've got the sort of hook drop shot, and as the chair crashes through the basketball hoop and he just delivers that pay up sucker line as the ambulance kicks in, and you just know that you're on for a really good, really good story.
I'm getting ready to dunk on you, huh?
You couldn't dunk donuts.
Hey, Dollar.
You got it.
Step aside, chump. Pay up, sucker.
And then, of course, you get the more, you get Quarterflash, who were the opening sort of night shift song by Quarterflash is a generic 80s film track. And it reminds me a lot of the opening, although it's a hearse and not an ambulance. It's a very sort of Rocky II opening. Of the hearse going through New York City to the city morgue, where we meet Harry Winkler and Shelley Long. Henry Winkler playing Charles Chuck Lumley and Shelley Long playing Belinda, the prostitute with a heart of gold. Oh, I don't know, what, 8 years before Julia Roberts did it?
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I mean, one thing you did mention about Henry Winkler playing against type, and I saw one of the quotes was that he wanted to play Richie Cunningham. In the film. And I mean, I'm trying to think, because I'm not really up on which season of Happy Days. Had he jumped the shark at this point?
I think he probably had. Mm. I think we'd have to check that. But I think, so if it started 74, they're filming 82. They've got to be filming season 8 or 9, haven't they?
Yeah.
And I think it ended not long after 82. I think people, the viewing figures dropped off, and, you know, Stephen J. Cannell's right in the A-team now, and Happy Days. But Happy Days was a staple of the UK Saturday night in 82. Yeah. No, there wasn't a person in the world that didn't know who the Fonz was, you know.
Well, even now, you know.
Well, I had a chat with Harry Winkler on Twitter about this film, and he maintains that in his 50-year career, this is the film that stands out for him as the funniest film that he's done. And I just asked him outright on Twitter about it, and he replied. And I got more emails and WhatsApps from my mates going, "Are you having a chat with the Fonz?" Which was just a bit the most surreal thing that had ever happened to me on Twitter, in a nice way. I've had some. I had a chat with the Fonz about Night Shift on Twitter.
There are worse chats you can have with worse people. But I mean, he's still doing. Have you seen Barry on Sky Atlantic? He's in that, and he's playing this kind of. He's an acting coach. And he's involved in these serial killers and this whole thing. And you can see elements of it there, where he's playing part of it's a frustrated actor who never quite made it. And there's also these scenes where he's a bit smaller time, and it works really well. I mean, that's a good show.
He's pretty good as the dad of one of the girlfriends in Parks and Rec as well.
Oh, of course, yeah.
He turned up in that, and he's pretty good in everything he's in.
Yeah.
And also, whenever you see him interviewed, he's such a nice guy. Mm. You just know that through to the core that you're not going to find anything. There's no, he's not getting cancelled anytime soon. He's just a genuinely, genuinely, genuinely nice guy.
I think that would ruin a lot of people's childhoods if he got cancelled, wouldn't it?
But it's crazy. The other tie-in with this film that I noticed this week is as we record this in February 2021, the big popular sort of crime thing on Netflix at the moment is the Disappearance at the Cecil Hotel, which was, funnily enough, produced by Brian Grazer and Ron Howard, who are responsible for Night Shift. I don't want to spoil the Disappearance at the Cecil Hotel for you, but it's not great. Somebody disappears and they, well, anyway. So,
it's not the City Morgue, anyway.
The City Morgue. So basically the premise of this is Franklin, who is Belinda, Shelley Long's pimp, has been murdered by the, what are we going to call them? The pimp masters.
Yeah.
So I think pimps pay off gangsters, don't they? Prostitutes pay off pimps and pimps pay off gangsters. Mm. And Franklin the pimp hasn't been paying off the gangsters. So they've dropped him out a window through a basketball hoop and he's turned up at the morgue. And we meet a wizened and bitter and twisted New York police officer and Henry Winkler's Chuck Lumley, a morgue attendant, and Shelley Long, a prostitute, who has to identify Franklin in the drawer. And she has a bit of interplay with Henry Winkler, says she thinks she recognises him, and he says, no, I wouldn't. And he starts one of a reoccurring joke where he breaks out a photo of his fiancée, and people comment on everything other than his fiancée, and we'll see why as we get to meet Charlotte very soon. And this is it. This is where we're into. We've got a murdered pimp and a prostitute and a mortuary, and that's all we know so far.
I mean, he's one of these characters that you see a lot in well, not just 80s films, a lot of films where he's quite this, I won't say downtrodden, but he's very, you know, methodical around his job. You know, he used to be a financial accountant before he went into being a mortuary assistant. He keeps his plant in his locker. It's all these little quirky things that, of course, you have to have this, you know, very vanilla guy, because when you're introduced to his new partner, because he's moved on to a night shift, you know, whole nepotism. I mean, it's Hollywood after all. And we've got, he moves to a night shift. You've got to bust in a new partner. Yeah. And it's Michael Keaton. So, of course, you've got to have the guy who's super methodical and then super outlandish.
And it's done beautifully in that scene where, like you said, he takes the rubber, he's got a light in his locker. He takes the rubber plant out of the locker. He lays a mat on the desk. He's got an electric pencil sharpener and he sharpens his pencil. Then he takes the little receptacle out of the pencil sharpener and tips it into the bin. And he sort of, then he lays his Wall Street Journal out on the desk. And like you said, he's been put onto night shift by his supervisor, Mr. Carboni, who there's a lovely little Mr. Carboni, who has my job? And the guy posts him a piece of paper and he says, Mr. Carboni, he seems to have the same last name that you do. And he says, yes, I think he's my nephew or something. And you get a feel of Henry's character in that he doesn't stand up for himself. And that's, again, a reoccurring theme. He just doesn't stand up for himself.
Yeah.
So the first day he turns up as night on the night shift, we get a nice scene of him going to work against the tide. Yeah. So he's getting on the New York subway as everybody's getting off. And it's a really good little soundtrack. And then we get to meet Leonard Carboni, who's the supervisor's nephew. And he's a real dick. And he basically doesn't do anything but watch the Flintstones all day and then leaves Chuck with a load of crap to clear up in the evenings. Deceased, something Polish.
I know a few people like that. When I used to work night shifts and you take over from the day shift and it'd just be like, oh, sorry, yeah, I'm off home now.
So what we've got is Henry Winkler accepting that he's on night shift, but he's got his quiet little life back and he's got his rubber plant out of the locker and he's ready to go. And on 15 minutes, you get Keaton and the entrance of Keaton. And it is perfectly, perfectly done.
Hi. How you doing? I'm Bill Blaze Jasky. You call me Billy Blaze. You must be Chuck, right? Nice shoes. Hey, this is all right. Guess this is where I'm going to be working. I'm your new partner.
I love the, you know, reading about this, that he got into character by listening to Bruce Springsteen really loud. I mean, that's, you know, a good way of getting yourself worked up anyway. But he has this entrance and it becomes, because you can see his silhouette approaching through this frosted glass door, he's kind of whirling in. I mean, not quite like a Tasmanian devil, but he is that kind of be like Cat from Red Dwarf, where he's walking, that kind of entrance. It was massive.
It's a huge entrance. And this is where you see Winkler's brilliant reaction to, because you've just got to let Michael Keaton go with this. He doesn't let Winkler get a word in edgeways for about 5 minutes. I mean, he goes to the desk and picks up the photo of the girlfriend, fiance. Yeah. Nice frame, which is a brilliant joke when he's looked at a picture of his. And then he goes on to his tape. Do you want to know why I carry this tape recorder? And Chuck shakes his head. No, he doesn't want to know, but he's going to tell him anyway. And he says that he's an ideas man. And he runs through an idea for edible paper. He's got a couple of musicals. And then he asks to be shown around. And he realizes very quickly that the supervisor is just going to be Chuck and Bill. Billy Blazajowski, Billy Blaze, working nights on this night shift. The scene ends with Henry Winkler opening the drawer and Keaton exclaiming, that guy is dead.
That's what I wrote down here. And he even has this story about how his girlfriend turned lesbian and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this is someone he's just met 5 minutes before when he's already basically told him his life story.
Massive oversharer. But just, there's something electric about this Keaton performance. And I to do some extra research for this, I'm a huge Keaton fan anyway, you know, Beetlejuice, Batman, Pacific Heights, through the 90s. And I watched Spotlight at the weekend, which obviously won a lot of Oscars. And Keaton plays Walter Robinson of the Boston, the paper that uncovered the child. And he's so serious and good. And he's a real good career arc for Michael Keaton, but you take it right the way back to this, and this is what set him on the stratospheric rise to, you go Night Shift to Mr. Mum to Johnny Dangerously, Johnny Dangerously to Beetlejuice to Batman, and from there on it just goes. I don't think, if it's got Michael Keaton in it, it's usually a pretty good movie.
And even when he's in, you know, smaller roles, he still turns up, he still holds things together, he still, you know, if it's in a comedy, I mean, sometimes we see, I mean, it's difficult to be as wild as Bill is in this. You know, I mean, we've seen, I know off the top of my head, The Other Guys. He was the police captain who just made these really random TLC references. But, you know, again, there's those cameos and you know, even was going into Birdman and all these other things that he's done. And now, what, nearly 40 years after Night Shift, we're coming back and he may be playing Batman again in some fucking universe, however that works. The guy is that, he's so strong in anything that you put him in, you know, comedy, drama, you know, that the action as well. I mean, you know, part of the Batman thing is he's not a big guy, but Batman is a normal guy. You know, you look at Batman, he shouldn't necessarily be this massive big guy. He's someone who uses his brain, someone who's, and you know, I mean, the way Keaton plays Batman, I mean, I'm going into the whole Batman episode here, but he plays him, he has that edge to him that he isn't this Val Kilmer, George Clooney type, played it completely wrong, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
I always thought, who's the comedian that they brought in to play Alexander Knox in Batman? Because
what was his name?
Robert Wool. Is it Robert Wool?
Possibly.
W-U-H. So Robert Wool, who was Knox in Batman, is effectively playing the same role he played in Good Morning Vietnam, as the sort of annoying sidekick.
Yeah.
And he kind of was brought in to out Keaton, so that when Keaton's introduced, there's a lot of, you know, the king of the wicker people, there's an air of mystery about him. So Keaton was pretty reined in as Batman after Beetlejuice and this. But in this, I can watch this film over and over. I've watched this film 100 times, and him as Billy, he makes me laugh as Billy Blaze every time. There are four or five laugh out loud moments that we'll get to, that where Keaton just absolutely, I mean, he chews the scenery up in every scene he's in. He's just wonderful.
But even the next scene after this, when he's got himself established, I think this is the second night, because we've seen that Chuck goes home and that Belinda, the prostitute, is actually the girlfriend of his next door neighbour, which is how they know each other.
She's got a huge cowboy, looks like a Will Ferrell on steroids around, playing loud music. And Chuck's own girlfriend goes home because turns out she's a bit of an uptight. She's extremely uptight, and she won't have sex with Chuck unless the conditions are perfect. And we meet Belinda, and he realises he lives next door to Belinda.
And there's that kind of awkward interplay there. But when they go back to work the next night, Bill's already got himself, he's got the hearse hired out as a limo for a debutante ball. Yeah. And of course, because it's a Ron Howard film, Clint Howard, his brother, turns up. And just the way that Michael Keaton is, he's decking the hearse out to cover the markings on it. He's got the decal on the side, the little hat on the front, on the top.
And he's got a justification for everything. So when Henry Winkler's Chuck says, what if we have to go and get a body? It's like, well, when I get there, they won't be dead anymore. You know, it's like, and so he's basically, is this what you do every night? He goes, no, some nights I pick up people from the airport. Diplomats, you're ripping off diplomats. And he sticks $100 in his hand and then asks the kid if he likes music. And then when he says he does, he starts humming Jumping Jack Flash and drives off. And again, it's another electric scene.
Yeah.
Of course, we get another idea on his tape recorder on that scene where he decides that if you fed mayonnaise to tuna fish, that you would get tuna mayo straight in the can.
I did wonder, because the other idea he had related to that was just pack them in the can with mayo.
That's it.
I don't know. Do they do that?
I think there was there was something on IMDb trivia that says that every idea that Bill has come to fruition in one way or another.
Yeah, because I mean, some of them were like edible paper, I think was one of them, or edible rubbish, something like that.
He mentions going to Atlantic City, and he says, I'm not going to get a room, I'm going to get those wash and dryers. Did I tell you I thought of them first? Only they already had them. Now, I don't know what a wash and dry is, but it's a really well-delivered line, and it's basically that, like, I've invented everything, but when I've come to check it out, it turns out they already exist.
And this is the kind of guy he is, you know, he's 100 miles an hour all the time. He has his tape recorder to have his ideas. And yet it doesn't take him long to start implementing these little money-making schemes around, you know, the mortuary and everything, and how to monetize everything, I suppose. He'd do really well as an influencer these days. But, I mean, when we have the scene of Chuck comes across Belinda, she's hurt in the lift, and he gets beaten up by these Girl Scouts, or whatever they're called, Bluebirds or something in America.
I think they're Bluebells, and the lead Bluebell who bursts into the lift, that's an early appearance of Beverly All 90210, Shannon Doherty. So that's her. There's another little cameo for people that like to spot people. So she's about 9 years old here, and she runs into the lift to save her. They think Chuck's the rapist
in a movie about prostitutes and pimps.
Yeah,
and this is the part where, you know, it becomes Bill, because Belinda's pimp is dead. She's out talking about the protection and the management that she gets from the pimps, and there's that kind of idea that Bill has, suggesting that they become a pimp and running out of the mortuary. And I mean, they're talking about it on the subway, and the way he describes them as being love brokers.
Love brokers.
It's just so spot on. It's like, we know this, we need to rebrand. We can't be pimps. It's superb.
You get the payoff to that when they decide, obviously, so the build-up to that is, like you just said, Belinda was beaten up in the lift by a client that won't pay. And Chuck takes her home, and he relays the story to Bill, and Bill suggests that they step in as the pimps. And what really cements this, you've got a lovely little gag at the end of that where he's love brokers and jumps off the tube. And then a saxophonist who with a begging cup comes up to sort of, with a little cup hanging off his saxophone, plays a little tune, and he puts a few coins in. And then he basically bullies Henry Winkler into writing him out a check. It's a really good little payoff line.
That was Ron Howard. That was his cameo.
You then get Belinda knocking on Chuck's door, and she notices that they come home from work every morning off the night shift at the same time, and she suggests that they have breakfast together. And Chuck, for the first time in the film, you see genuinely happy about this. And as he's getting ready to go into the kitchen, he sees Shelley Long's ass bent over the cooker, and he has a hot flash. And Charlotte, Chuck's fiance, phones, and you get a really funny little phone call where he's trying to talk to his fiance, who's moaning about cheating and eating marshmallows on the way to the wedding, and he can't concentrate on the phone call, and he actually hangs up while not even talking to her, while continuing to ogle Shelley Long's character.
Yeah, he suddenly gets very defensive. I mean, that's a kind of thing about the relationship, and that's one of those that gets, again, played throughout films. I mean, the Hangover, that sort of thing, where there's, I mean, she's overbearing in some degree and then incredibly neurotic in other ways. And he has to kind of be the peacemaker and balance all those different split personalities out. But obviously here he's distracted by Belinda. And I mean, the way he, again, it's that reaction to what's going in his ears and what's going in his eyes at the same time. He's really struggling there.
And Winkler does really well with it. And he kind of plays it off. He pretty much plays it off beautifully. You still don't know whether he's sold yet on becoming pimps. So we cut to the breakfast scene for Chuck and Bill walking through New York's red light district. And then you get this lovely Keaton scene again, where he tries to justify why they should do it with a story about, and then it's a really off kilter story. And a bit problematic these days that he's, you know, he uses prostitution as a justification for Girl Scouts not getting jumped on. And then we move to a scene where Henry Winkler's having his hair cut, and to justify his story about why there should be prostitutes and why it's a completely moral thing that they should do, he shows him a newspaper headline that says Girl Scout attacked. Henry Winkler snatches the paper and he says, it's, you know, Girl Scout attacked by a dog. He has a go at Henry Winkler's barber. And I'm trying to be quite vague about this because I really don't want to spoil it with all the punchlines for people. You do have to see this. But what makes Chuck and Bill become pimps is the visit of Charlotte's parents for Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that he gets called to night court to bail Belinda out. She calls him because she's the neighbour, and she's, Franklin used to take care of all this stuff for her and all her money and stuff's at her house, and she's been arrested. And Charlotte Kugel, who's Chuck's fiance, and her parents, who are, they're sort of Presbyterian Texans, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're sort of God-fearing, sort of shoelace tie. You know, how do you like FSC? We don't.
So they, because even Chuck makes some jokes to them, and they kind of just sit there, go, nope.
Yeah,
nope.
Yeah. It's a really, really awkward. And a long story short, he ends up taking the whole family to night court, where Belinda's been charged with solicitation and assault. And you get this wonderful scene of a man dropping his trousers in court and baring his ass at the judge and the quite puritanical in-laws, and then having to drive back with Chuck's mother and Chuck's mother-in-law and Chuck's fiance all telling him he's moving away from that woman, he's moving out of the building. But what you do see is the resolve in his eyes. And then we cut to a scene where he's going to Billy's flat to tell him that he wants to do it.
The scene, it is quite amusing, where Bill explains he's got a whole mortuary full of prostitutes, which is funnier than it sounds. Let's be honest.
It's a blackboard explanation of pimping and prostitution by Michael Keaton.
I mean, and
it's difficult to describe, like you say. It's a genius scene, and the long and short of it is, it ends up with him asking to see their breasts and nearly getting decapitated by a flying angle poise lamp.
and there's good visual gags in there that he played. I mean, the way he breaks down the word prostitution. I mean, there must have, what, 20, 25 prostitutes in there. Yeah. And he's saying about pro, you know.
Doesn't really mean anything. Yeah, tit. I think we all know what that means. and shove doesn't even belong in this word.
What are we really talking about here? Huh? What's the essence? What we're talking about. I'll spell it out for you if I have to. Prostitution.
Hmm? What are you kidding? Exactly.
What is this?
Prostitution. Hey, we can say it. We're big kids now, right? You know, a lot of times it'll help you to understand a word if you break it down. So let's do that now, shall we? Pros. Doesn't mean anything. Forget about that. Tit, I think we all know what that means. Two.
Okay, two.
Tit. And shun, of course, from the Latin to shun. To say no, uh-uh. Thank you anyway, I don't want it. To push away. Doesn't even belong in this word, really. So let's get rid of that.
And he's starting to dress like Chuck in order to, like, look more like a teacher kind of thing. And he goes through the whole procedure. And I mean, I don't know why I wouldn't have known this anyway, but when they talk about the percentage that they normally pay to the pimps, you know, 70, 80, 90%. And then Chuck goes straight in, we'll take 10%, and starts all this stuff about medical plans, dental plans, pensions, investments, all this kind of thing, you know, preaching to his former career. And it's kind of like, I mean, it's interesting when you think of pimps, and of course, you know, most of this is through film and TV and books and stuff, where you don't really see that idea, and you think of pimps as just muscle and protection. And now they're engineering it as though they're, you know, running it as a proper business with proper employees.
Well, Chuck and Bill are going into the Henry Winkler's Chuck is genuinely going into this for altruistic reasons, isn't he? He saw his flatmate, cool girlfriend, beaten up on the floor of an elevator. And he is genuinely going in to run a sort of side business to alleviate the boredom of night shift, but to also help these women out. And we do see throughout the film that as the money comes in, he is investing it for them and he's genuinely taking care of them. And Michael Keaton's character comes round to that way of thinking as well, although he's a little bit more flash and he spends his money. And you see the contrast between the two guys, the way they spend their money. In a, you know, you get a cut montage scene and an Al Jarreau song, and you see sort of how this is going. And it rattles along quite quickly.
So I've got montage here in big letters.
Yeah, I've got montage. So you get a... So the long and short of it is Henry Winkler's Chuck character is sticking all his ill-gotten gains into coffee jars in his cupboard and hiding it all away. And he's using a spreadsheet with VisiCalc and making sure everyone's getting what they're getting. The women are getting better clients, nicer clothes. They're working fewer hours for more money, and they genuinely seem to be enjoying what they're doing. I don't know what that says. It's probably a little problematic by 2021 standards. However, we'll go with it for now. And Michael Keaton is spending his money on flash suits, jewellery, watches, fast cars, and he's starting to dress like a pimp.
Yeah.
He is really enjoying pimping.
Well, that car he buys, we see a little bit later, it is virtually a pimpmobile.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Solid gold dash and everything.
Yeah. But then we finish the montage and you cut to a scene of Henry Winkler with Alka-Seltzer on his desk. And he's broken. He looks stressed. He's, you know, and then he lays it on Chuck that he hasn't slept since he started doing this. His hair is falling out. He's got alopecia. Henry Winkler says this wonderful, there are women lying in strange beds with strange men. And we are making money from that. And Keaton replies, "Is this a great country or what?"
And that's the thing, isn't it? He's embracing pimphood. It's almost like his calling. And this is where we see again the difference between the two. We know that Chuck is takes his job seriously. Everything, he's running the pimping as a side hustle, to give it 2021 sort of words. And when he comes in and there's this massive frat party going on that Bill sorted because he's got them all back to the morgue. And I mean, it's absolute chaos. And this is where cameo alert. This is the first on-screen appearance for a certain Mr. Kevin Costner.
Your first role was what?
My first role as a SAG was in Night Shift, you know, Michael Keaton. I was an extra.
Night Shift, yes.
Yeah. So, and then
Howard.
The Big Chill was really it. And yeah, that's me. I'm 22 or 23. I'm not sure how old I am. Actually, it happened for me. I think I'm about 26, 27. I remember I screamed really loud right at that point. And I remember Michael kind of jerked because he was the main actor. He was being paid a lot of money. And he turned and looked at me and said, "When we do this again, would you do that again?" So I was like, "Yeah, thanks." And then I saw him the other night, you know, win his award.
Did he remember that was your first?
No, I've never brought it up to him.
That's amazing that you worked with him and
yeah.
You're seeing each other.
Yeah, it is funny. I'm working as an extra. I mean, I was over in London and I see Ronnie Howard. Now we'll talk about things, but just little small beginnings.
Yep, and Bobcat
amazing.
Goldthwait.
Yes.
Also turns up in this scene. So yeah, Michael Keaton's doing a beer balancing frat party trick. Apparently, one of the in-jokes here as well, and was a tribute to Belushi, is the frat fraternity that's partying in the morgue is the same frat from Animal House.
Yeah.
That's one of the trivia moments. So yeah, you see a young Kevin Costner sort of doing a beer balancing trick with Keaton, and early appearances by Bobcat Goldthwait, of course, of Police Academy fame as Zed.
Hero. And another appearance for Clint Howard as well.
Yes, absolutely. Ron's little brother.
I mean, everything about, I mean, that screams 80s movie. I mean, it's like a bachelor party kind of crossover, that sort of thing. And again, you know, Chuck gets very stressed out about it and everything, you know, because he's worried that if, again, if you lose your main job, what have you got? You know, how are you meant to run it out of anywhere else? And the next day he goes for bagels with Belinda and he starts kind of giving off his frustrations about his relationship to her. And she's very casual about telling these stories. And the relationship between them is building up in a, you know, a side, you know, I guess he falls, well, I say falls in love with a prostitute, again, Pretty Woman precursor. But it's, yeah. I mean, the way they handled that, there is a little bit, and again, sort of jumping ahead slightly, he is such a nice guy and he's so vanilla, but he does have these preconceptions about her because she's a prostitute. He falls in love with her and he has expectations that are probably both unrealistic and, you know, again, by modern standards, aren't probably very pleasant.
Yeah, she tells a story about when she was once hired by a client to go up in a helicopter and do it over the ex-wife's house after the divorce was finalized. You kind of get Henry Winkler's Chuck's moral compasses that she says to him, don't you ever have a fantasy about a way you want to do it? And he just replies, for once, I'd like to do it without having to check the apartment first. and it just shows he's like a very simple man with very simple tastes. And he still finds what he's doing morally repugnant, although he's almost convincing himself he's not actually doing it. Because yeah. Then you cut to the burger steak franchise scene where he takes 15 prostitutes into a burger steak in New York City and tells the girls that they all own it. He's invested their money for them and he's bought them they've all got a poison of, at which point they all start leaping over the counter and sort of looting the place.
I suppose we'd do that if start deciding they want to buy a pub or you know, that sort of thing. They take it over. I mean, well, it's our own food we're stealing.
As soon as they steal all the stuff from the burger steak, we cut back to Franklin's murderers, and they've now reappeared, and they know that somebody's working Franklin's girls, and they're not seeing a penny of the money. So another guy gets beaten up and dumped in an alley in the New York. It's lovely New York. A scene of a man being thrown over a load of garbage cans, just as he's it's a classic of the genre. Yeah. You know, the final kick is through a load of dustbins in a New York alley where the steam's coming up through the grate.
I mean, that they're kind of their role in the film and their character names, Cleon and Pig. I mean, they're great names if you're going to be a pimp master. But I think the whole issue around that is it's interesting how they then work their way into the mortuary. I mean, we'll see that a little bit later on, but their kind of shadow looms and they're not in it an awful lot. I mean, we've got the beginning scene where they kill the initial pimp and then this scene where they're looking for who's running them now. But then, you know, they don't have a lot of screen time, which you'd think if you're going to have menace or villains throughout the film, they don't do it because in theory, the kind of the peril that they meet throughout is actually the conflict of what they're doing. It's not necessarily these guys. They're not the ones who are the big boss. You know, the big boss is the relationship between Chuck and Bill, between Chuck and Belinda, and how that all plays out. And that's what really takes you through to the end of the film.
But and that's it. I think the thing with the two gangsters is they are finished. They don't have a lot of screen time, but when they are on, they are sufficiently menacing that you know that this isn't going to pan out well for when they finally get hold of Chuck and Bill. But as soon as the guy gets beaten up in the alley, we cut to the Christmas party that they have at the mortuary again. And Lupe, the Puerto Rican call girl, gives a speech, quite a funny speech. And Bill gets given a new tape recorder and Chuck gets given a fur fedora as a pimp's hat. And then we see a lovely little scene with Chuck, Belinda and Bill. They're drunk in the morgue and you get a real bit of insight into Bill's character. And it's a lovely bit of acting by Keaton. He kind of really reins it in and you basically find out that he had a terrible childhood and that's what's made him like he is. And then he does this really, really bit with his tape recorder where he says, call mum and wish her a Merry Christmas. And it's really, really sweet. And then they give Chuck a hard time for not spending any of his money. And we see Bill's souped up pimp car driving to a cemetery. And Chuck says that he shows that the only money he's spent since he started doing this terrible business that he's running is he's bought a headstone for his father.
I mean, it's these kind of poignant pieces dropped in little places throughout the film. It's one of these that I think it would struggle to carry too many of them. And I think there's enough throughout where, I mean, this is probably where they're most concentrated, but, you know, it just kind of grounds us a little bit in that these aren't bad guys.
It could have gone really saccharine and very pretty woman, and it doesn't. It just about stays away from it because, like you said, they drop it in very little doses. But you just get a feel for... I suppose the only complaint I would have about this is that Shelley Long, while a good actress and while a very good 80s actress and a very, very, very good comedy actress, you just don't buy Belinda as a cool girl. She's too nice. She's too girl next door. She's too nice. She's got too much of a moral code. You just can't imagine her doing what she does.
I think that's the thing where, you know, again, this kind of does lead into Pretty Woman a bit more, that the majority of the group of prostitutes are a lot more street. They're a lot more kind of what you'd expect. You know, there's an element of kind of aggression there that they, you know, that you'd probably need to have that toughness. You know, the scene where they're trying to explain to them about why they should let them be their pimps, and some of the comments back, you know, they're like,
these guys are snowing us, this is too easy, they're too nice,
these two essentially weedy little white guys.
Yeah,
I don't talk about Batman and the Fonz, but yeah. And then we get to the point where Belinda is so nice, and, you know, don't want to generalize or anything, but as the kind of almost unofficial leader of this group of women, she does seem, is accessible. She kind of falls in love with Chuck, and they have the scene where they end up in bed, but in the bath.
But yeah,
and he starts talking about Clute.
It's a really well done scene because, again, it could have been really saccharine. And when she sort of declares her love for Chuck and he declares his love for her, he says that, you know, she says, you're like a saint, you're Saint Chuck. And then he sort of unravels and says, you know, from the first time I saw you in your underwear, you know, my pulse didn't get below like 90, and there's your Saint Chuck. And they kiss and they end up in the bath. And like you say, he recounts the story from Clute, and what he's trying to do is check that she's not faking, and she assures him that she's not. And it's quite sweet. It's a little bit, it probably veers, it's a couple of sweeteners, but it's pulled away from quite quickly. And then it cuts back to the mortuary for that night. And obviously Chuck comes into work like Bill's first entrance.
Well, exactly, yeah. It's the same silhouette in the door.
Jumping Jack Flash humming. Yeah, and he's for the first time you see Henry Winkler's Chuck genuinely happy that he's fallen in love, and he's in. This is one of my favourite scenes in the film. And again, massive props to Michael Keaton for the way he plays this. What you have here is Chuck going to work happy because he thinks Belinda's not going to show for work. He thinks that with everything that's gone between them, she's not going to show up. And of course, she walks in 5 minutes after. And Bill's in the Chuck role here, saying, "Where have you been? I've got bodies coming in. I've got girls going out. I don't know what, you know." And then Belinda shows up, and Chuck and Belinda start having a chat, and the penny drops with Bill that they're an item. And he goes, "Get out of town, you two guys." And then they're like, he's kind of interrupting the conversation, and it's an awkward scene because Chuck wants to tell her, you know, she's saying, "Why shouldn't I go to work?" She's begging him to tell her why she shouldn't go to work, and he won't. And Bill, she storms out, and Chuck's very upset, and Bill says, "I have to drive her." And he spins back to say, "I need the keys." And just as he spins back, they land right in his eye. And it's just, I can't, you have to see the scene to really appreciate it. But this had tears of laughter. Every time I've watched it, I've cried laughing at the way Keaton pulls this scene off, because it must have been really hard. And you can imagine, you know, where props are involved and they have to land. They probably shot this about 50 times. Keaton brings it, and it's just laugh out loud funny. Because it's just the kind of awkward it's the kind of awkward comedy that you'd see 20 years later in The Office. And it's very early and it's very understated and it's very clever. And then 5 minutes after, he drives Belinda away. And then you see that Bill's got real heart because he doesn't want her to go to bed with another man. He says, I'm going to drive you home and then I'll come back and get him drunk and take his clothes off. And in the morning, he'd think he was with you. And he does that wonderful line where he goes, you know, he's a funny guy. He probably thought you guys were in love. And Shelley Long's character replies, you know, so did I.
Look, he didn't mean what he said.
Yes, he did.
No, he's a strange guy. You know, he's not like you and me. He probably thought, you two were in love.
So did I.
I mean, it's like something you get in a Judd Apatow film, isn't it? Where there's always that hook about two-thirds of the way into the film where there's always like a breakup or there's a bump in the road of a relationship or something like that they then have to overcome.
Yeah, Keaton's very much the kind of Chris O'Dowd police officer in Bridesmaids at this point, isn't he? He's kind of revealed himself to be a good guy. But not that good that he doesn't go to a nightclub to try and solicit some more business, which turns out to be quite handy for Chuck, because Chuck's back at the mortuary being depressed, answering the phone, somebody died, who cares? And Franklin's murderers show up.
I mean, they come in and there's the whole scene where they said, oh, you know, he was our friend. And then immediately tells, oh, I'll be your friend. I want
to
be your friend.
Wouldn't be right to let you live after we killed Franklin, and Franklin was our friend.
And just that sort of coincidental part, because Bill's at the nightclub and has ended up trying to offer ladies of the night to two undercover cops
who are desperate to get back to Vice.
They go back to the mortuary just as Chuck is being taped down to the gurney in the mortuary and about to be waterboarded, early waterboarding scene here.
With a throat filleting thrown in. Again, you get a lovely physical Keaton scene. Where he unlocks the door to, you know, hey, what's going on here? And the guys spin around with guns and he just does a, excuse me, and then dives behind her.
Get ready to fill them up.
Yeah.
This is to make some holes so the water comes out.
Again, luck.
Excuse me.
Yes. Police!
You guys are police?
And you get all of a sudden, you know, this film goes from a comedy about prostitution and morgues into a, you know, a short shootout.
Yeah.
You know, two cops, two robbers. And it ends in a kind of comedy farcical way where Munch shoots himself in the foot and ends up giving up in the middle of the shootout. And it just works so nicely because it just brings you back down going, yes, this is a comedy, while Keaton's being inundated with bits of blinds and shutters landing on him while he's cowering in the corner and Chuck's spinning around while taped to this thing, just going, oh my, you know, amazingly, he hasn't been shot yet.
There's some very, very good dialogue. And it's really beautifully shot as well. It's a bold comedy because the subject, it's a Beverly Hills Cop level of seriousness. In that you could buy the story, but they never really veer towards, I suppose the gangsters are quite realistically terrifying, but you, like you say, you know, the guy shoots himself in the foot and the cops arrest everybody because everybody's committing an offence here. They're running a prostitution ring from a mortuary and you've got a gunfight at the mortuary spinning table.
It just, you know, one of those things where it then feeds into them having their photos taken in custody. And like a lot of good 80s films, you know, from everything from Stir Crazy to Death Wish 3, there's an amusing scene in a cell, in a communal cell, because, of course, in films, everyone's in one cell. And they're having their big kind of falling out as such. You know, Chuck's life is ruined. And
it's very Stir Crazy, isn't it? And of course, then you get your I've underlined problematic 80s homophobic joke.
Yeah, there's that, the guy on the bed while he's kind of on his knees, you know, on his haunches.
I've sunk as low as I can go.
Yeah.
It was a bit, that's the one joke in the film, you couldn't get away with it now. And rightly so,
Yeah.
But they, it seemed to be an ever-present... It was an easy joke in the 80s. It was an easy go-to gag in the 80s.
Yeah.
I think it's the most problematic joke in the film. Given the subject matter of the film, it's the one joke that you could probably... I think it would be edited out on a TV reshow. Even if you put it after 9 p.m., after 10 p.m., I think that joke gets cut if you show it on television, because it's a different time now.
Yeah, but even then, it's kind of, you know, it's an implied thing where my life couldn't get any worse. Oh, there's a gay guy in the next bed.
Blowing kisses at me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, when you compare it to some of its peers, I mean, there's prison scenes in, you know, Trading Places and all this kind of stuff where there probably are worse jokes that probably do still make it to TV because it's part of the film. I guess it depends on what angle they're aiming this at. I mean, I'm surprised, you know, we talked about it. I'm sure some of people on Twitter that we're mutual, they keep a list of how many times a film's been on telly and when was it at first and last broadcast and all that shit. And I'm sure, you know, this is the sort of film that you'd have on a Channel 5 or something late night. You know, I genuinely cannot see it being advertised.
I can't remember that. I know this was on television because when I first saw it, sort of 84, we'd hired it like you would have done from the video shop, and it went back. And then it was repeated on television because I taped it and I had it for a number of years as a tape, and it was on Channel 4. I remember the building block stickle brick Channel 4 logo on ad breaks. I don't recall anything being cut from it. And I used to show it to anybody that would watch it because it's a really well kept secret. I mean, you hadn't seen it. You hadn't seen it until very recently. And it is up there for me with Silver Streak, Beverly Hills Cop.
I'm surprised it doesn't get, you know, you rarely see it getting mentioned even, you know. I'm not saying that, you know, people are going to say this is Ron Howard's greatest achievement.
No, it's not.
As a debut film for someone who's gone on to make, you know, some of the biggest films, you know, Oscar-winning films, films that have spawned,
and
you know,
Solo.
Huge, you know, and Solo. Not even then, he only did about half of that. But it's this is something that really, like you say, I mean, that homophobic joke, and it's probably not as bad as some of its contemporaries in the grand scheme of things, because a lot, you know, it is implied. You think that's the worst thing about it, and this film's nearly 40 years old. You think this film really... I mean, the thing is that people might judge it for now is its portrayal of prostitution, where perhaps attitudes have changed into that. Perhaps a lot of people are forced into prostitution rather than there's the element that a lot of these people do it by choice, which of course some people do and that. But
I think the other thing as well is what you always get with Hollywood prostitution is all the girls playing cool girls, all the women playing cool girls in this are 8 to 9 out of 10 by a Hollywood rating. As somebody that was in the armed forces and served overseas, I'm going to go on record now and say I've never been with a prostitute, nor have I ever, nor would I ever. But where you have soldiers based, you have brothels, and it gives you a sort of off-kilter appreciation of what prostitution is actually about. It's a really, really scary, nasty industry that's controlled by, and that is implied in this film. Yeah. That is implied in this film by the gangsters. When the gangsters are there, they are scary. And this was based on a little column, a little newspaper report of a New Jersey mortuary where they were running a prostitution ring. And obviously you can write a comedy around that, and they did.
I'm sure it wasn't done in the comedy way that you'd need a Henry Winkler and a Michael Keaton to portray.
No. You know, and it's never... If you move in those circles, you are ultimately going to come unstuck in a manner not unlike Henry Winkler being strapped to a gurney and people wanting to fill at his throat in order to let the water out, where they're going to stick a hose in his mouth and waterboard him to death. But the guys end up in jail. They get bailed by the girls. And we cut to the... We're in a city official's office, and Chuck and Bill ask if they're going to go to jail. And it turns out that there's a mayoral election in New York City that year, and this whole thing's been very embarrassing to everybody. And it would just be as well as everybody got their jobs back And we didn't say any more about it, and we pretended that the whole thing didn't happen. To which Henry Winkler's Chuck is obviously over the moon, and he, you know, he wants to go back. But Keaton's Bill knows that they've got the city over a barrel, and in keeping with his character, he wants more. He doesn't want to let this lie now. He's like, you know, Chuck begs Bill for his life back, and Bill thinks about it and says, "No, I couldn't do that to you." And they end up having a really comedic, very physical fight with a tennis racket. That's the other thing about this scene. Keaton turns up for this, what he thinks is what might be an arraignment or something, in tennis whites, which is just...
And at one point, I think Chuck has him on the floor. He's like, careful, I'm wearing white.
Yeah, or you've got, and when he swings the tennis racket in, you've got to keep that elbow straight.
I say we get down there right now, all right? And we march right into the mayor's office. We lay it on the line. You want to? Come on, it'll be fun.
It'll be great.
Chuck, I'm wearing white. Crazy. Chuck. Get away from the door.
Jack, I got away from this
for you. You're not going to see the mayor. You're not going to make any demands for her. I'm going to kill you. You're going to play tennis with God. Now, are you going to change your mind?
No.
Are you going to change your mind? Chuck, you got to keep that elbow stiff.
I mean, that's the thing. He's just taken on this persona that he's even in this scene. And they're going their separate ways. You know, Chuck's very straight with him, saying, I don't want to have anything to do with you. I don't even want to hear rumors about you.
Yeah.
And at this point, they go back and the job becomes, or the rest of the movie becomes, how the three leads kind of get their lives back to where they were.
Yeah, we're definitely about to enter the third act, aren't we? Which is, we're going to get back to where we started. And
yeah, because you've got Belinda's moving out of her apartment. Chuck finally stands up to Vincent Schiavelli.
Yeah, Vincent Schiavelli.
The sandwich, man.
Well, yeah. I can't believe you and I have missed this. We've missed a reoccurring joke in this film about with a dog as well.
Oh,
so every time Chuck comes out of his apartment, he gets chased back into his apartment by a dog, by a very ferocious dog.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she's, like you say, Vincent Schiavelli, who a lot of your listeners will know as Bond's assassin in Tomorrow Never Dies.
He was also in the previous, he was in the Better Off Dead episode we did. He was the teacher in that.
And I think he's the first ghost that Patrick Swayze meets in the subway.
The guy teaches him how to
move coins.
That sort of stuff.
And yeah. So Vincent Schiavelli, if you know Vincent Schiavelli as an actor, he's got a very, very distinctive face. And he walks into the... So we've got two recurring jokes that we've actually missed here. One is every time Chuck orders food, they send it to him wrong and he never sends it back.
Yeah.
And it just paints what his character. And two, when he comes out of his flat, every time he comes out of his apartment, he gets chased back into his apartment by a ferocious dog that lives on the fourth floor on the landing somewhere. And what you get in this turnaround in Chuck's character, partly to the teachings of Bill and partly because he's in love with Belinda and wants to go after her, is you get the payoff to these two jokes, which is the guy comes out of the lift with a sandwich that says, "Where the fuck is 4K? Which is incidentally what I shout at Sky Q boxes when I can't set them up properly. And what I want to shout at the BBC when they put me on that fucking holding screen for the news. And Vincent Schiavelli, basically, Chuck complains about there being mustard on his sandwich. Vincent Schiavelli scrapes the mustard down Chuck's door and then heads back to the lift. He says, "It's for $4. I've already deducted my tip." And little old Chuck, little old Henry Winkler, chases the big 6-foot man back to the lift, sticks his fist through the lift door to stop it closing, and unloads on him. "Never again will I eat a sandwich I didn't order." And sends him to go clean off the door. The dog runs around the corner to bully, and he just points at it. He looks a lot like Woody, actually.
Yeah,
"You,
it does.
You go home." And the dog goes away with it.
I was watching it. Woody was next to me when I was watching it yesterday, and he kind of pays attention
to other dogs.
When dogs come on the screen, he kind of looks up a bit. And I think when Chuck finally stood up to him, he was a bit like, "Oh, have I done something wrong?" But yeah, this is it. You know, it's kind of him shedding his that downtrodden vanilla image. You know, he's now standing up for himself.
Yeah,
he because flips. This is what he needs to do in order to get Belinda back, because she's now working at what I can only call a fucking legalized, well, not illegal, a members only orgy club.
It's a sex club, isn't it? Let's be honest. I mean, what's it called? Paradise Lost.
Yeah,
and it's run by Joe Spinell, who we all know as Willie Chichi from the Godfather movies, or
Rocky's
the guy that plays the loan shark. He's who Stallone's working for in Rocky and Rocky boss, 2. Yeah. He's Rocky Jose.
So
Chuck bursts into Paradise Lost looking for Belinda, and Bill's working there. He's a towelboy. And you get some great Keaton. there's a lovely little interplay between Chuck and Bill, where Keaton says, "Don't think I'm working here, because I'm not. I own this place." And then he turns to another towelboy. He's straighten that strap, and he goes, "Drop dead. Oh, you're fired. You're out of here." And then Chuck spots Belinda, and she's being chatted up by a guy who thinks she's fair game. He says, "I saw her first." And Chuck says, "Actually, no, I saw her first."
And and then Bill drops from the balcony.
Oh. It never not makes me laugh, that joke, even though I know what's coming. Mm. Michael Keaton launches himself. "Hang on, Chuck, I'm coming." And he launches himself over the balcony, and he just face plants like a star into the floor. And the sound, the way it's shot and the sound effects, it's perfect Laurel and Hardy slapstick. It's absolutely brilliantly done with Michael Keaton spread eagled on the floor.
Chuck?
Hold on, Chuck, I'm coming, buddy.
I mean, it worked perfectly, because at this point, Chuck's already been punched in the face. It's when they're talking about they're cradling Bill while he's hurt on the floor. They tell each other they love each other while they're basically holding his head, making sure he's staying conscious. It's, you know, just interesting to show that this relationship is effectively a three-way. Bill's in the middle, and Chuck and Belinda are kind of swooning over each other. It's sort of apt for the way the film ends and the way they kind of got together in the first place. And then they push the boss in the pond on the way out.
Exactly. It does feel like an early Judd Apatow film. Mm. You can see a lot of sort of 40-year-old virgin and bridesmaids jokes being done almost 20 years before. And that's why I'm surprised this film isn't more popular than it is. Whenever I introduce somebody to it, they've never heard of it. Nobody's ever heard of it. But when you do find people that have seen it and like it, they all like it.
Yeah.
So it's definitely one I'd recommend for, if you've not seen it, get a copy from somewhere and have a look.
This is one of those things where, again, it's easy to kind of, certain parts of the Betamax Twitter account lives in a certain part of Twitter. And when you talk about doing episodes about certain movies, you know, people get, "Oh my God, I love that." You know, when I talk about doing Better Off Dead, all of a sudden it brought people like, "Oh my God, I love that film, I haven't seen it for years." And then this, when I mentioned it, a lot of people got back saying, quoting bits from it, or, "Oh my God, I love that film, I can't wait to hear it," that sort of stuff. And it's kind of reassuring that, kind of think, even in our, where we happen to be, there's still a lot of people out there who have seen it. Maybe they haven't seen it for a long time, or it's not that easy to get hold of. But I mean, as you say, you know, I received an unsolicited email from you a couple of weeks ago and went, "What the fuck is that?" And it was like, you know, "Simon has bought you a film on iTunes. It's there on iTunes. Go and get it. Go and rent it," whatever.
That comes from your little website that you gave me when we did our first podcast at Heartbreak Ridge, which is we both are members of a club that alerts us when films drop under a certain price to buy from a streaming service.
Mm.
So I basically hold out now. Yeah. I've got like a cutoff point of films I like that's around the $5.99 mark.
Yeah.
And if it drops below £6 and it's available. I mean, I bought Mimi Leader's The Peacemaker this week, which is sort of a 90s action flick that I like with Clooney and Kidman. And Night Shift dropped in for under £6. And I was like, "Well, that's going in the collection." And I know who I need to send that to.
Well, funnily enough, given away the schedule of the podcast, the next episode's going to be Purple Rain. And that popped up on my app today saying you can now rent it for $1.99.
Yeah.
What happy days I'm having some of that.
It's a great movie. It's a great movie.
And this is where we're in a world where this is the kind of the counterpoint to what we've talked about in other episodes about how physical media is all great. If you've got the space to keep 1,000 VHS tapes or Betamax tapes or whatever on your shelf, whereas I can flick onto my phone and I've got instant access to 500 films on iTunes plus Netflix, Amazon, Disney, whatever, Sky. That is the counterpoint to it. And I guess we're kind of in a relatively fortunate position where here's a film I've not seen before. Bang, watch it on a Tuesday afternoon when I've got a day off work.
And that's exactly, this is one of, I think Night Shift is one of my go-to films where I've got 90 minutes to kill and I just want a few Michael Keaton-based giggles. And if you are a Michael Keaton fan and you followed Michael Keaton through the 80s with Johnny Dangerously, Mr. Mum, Beetlejuice, Batman, and you've not seen Night Shift, I heartily recommend you do. It's an absolute masterpiece. And I'm not sure, I mean, any other breakout performance like that, you'd be talking about a lot more. I think the thing we found when we mentioned we were recording this on Twitter, people did come to me and say, the people that have seen this film will come to you and say, I love that movie. Yeah. I love it. But it is like it feels like a well-kept secret. It feels like a really well-kept secret.
You do wonder if maybe if they just stuck it on ITV4 or Channel 5 or Comedy Central, you know, just once or twice and got the word out, just as a kind of, whether it would be part of a season they're doing or something, tie it into, the Fonz or Keaton or something like that. You think there is a market out there for it.
I'd be interested to know the last time it was shown on UK terrestrial telly.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to find that out.
Bear in mind as well, there's plenty of cult stuff on there when you look at the soundtrack, the fact that, you know, all the original music was written by Burt Bacharach.
Well, you've got Burt Bacharach did the music. You've got an Al Jarreau, Girls Know How. You've got Night Shift by Quarter Flash to start with. You've got That's What Friends Are For by Rod Stewart. And you've in the nightclub scene, you've got Talk Talk by Talk Talk. I mean, it's a banging soundtrack.
Mm.
And a pretty uplifting one as well. There's some big hitters involved in this film.
Yeah.
And it just sort of, like you say, it's not Apollo 11, it's not Backdraft. It's definitely not Solo. I quite like Solo. It's all right.
I'll tell you what though, you could imagine in a slightly, when you think about, you look at Apollo 13 and you think about this, and you think like a young Tom Hanks possibly could have done maybe not that Keaton role quite well, from some of the films that he did around.
He's not a million miles from Splash Tom Hanks, is he? Billy Blaze.
No. Well, this was, I think, was this, would have been the, this was 82, Splash was 84.
Yeah. Is Splash one of Ron Howard's?
It's Ron Howard, yeah.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? The flip side to that coin, of course, is you could see Keaton doing the Hanks role in Splash with Daryl Hannah.
Well, that'd be fun. I'd like that.
I'd watch the remake of that.
Yeah, and the less said of the sequel of that, the better. But well, thank you very much for sending me Night Shift. It was a joy. And if anyone is out there and fancies watching this, it might be on YouTube, I don't know. But definitely go and hunt it out. Absolutely got stellar performances. It's an early Ron Howard. There's cracking music. There's cracking jokes in it. If you're a Kevin Costner completist, whatever your fetish is, this film should cater for it in some way or another. Simon, thank you for bringing the film or sending it to me on that unsolicited email. Absolute joy. Now, we've talked before. You've done, this is your fourth appearance on the podcast after the, so we've had Clint, we've had Stallone twice. And now the Fonz and Keaton, it's quite a back catalogue.
It's not bad.
Yeah. Where can people find you on social media for more obscure films?
I would say don't. No, I am on Twitter as Simon from Harlow, and it's a timeline full of nonsense.
Yeah. Well, so there's plenty of stuff like this tucked away as well.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. Now, we discussed this off air. This did get a cinema release in the UK on the 26th of December, Boxing Day, 1982. The number one song, it wasn't as good as the last one. It was Save Your Love by Rene and Renata, wasn't it? Oh, God. Should we have That's What Friends Are For by Rod Stewart?
I think so.
Yeah, played over the closing credits of the film. It can play over the closing credits of the podcast. Oh, Simon, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you again.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Dregs, Matt Cunnington, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrill, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, Alan Fewings, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, Simon Pegg, Joe Harrison, Anita Singh, Doug Grant, Andrew Elliott, Bobby Richmond, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information around bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise and more.